Warning. The Savage Nation contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation, home of borders, language, culture. And here he is, Michael Savage. This is an encore presentation of The Savage Nation.
It is The Savage Nation.
I've got to get the angst going in order to keep the audience listening. I got to get them angry, I suppose. But I may not be doing much more of it. I am so beyond anger. I am so beyond rage at the political machine. I am so beyond wanting to change the Democrat or Republican parties that I could care less. I become apathetic at this point. I may change. Don't call me and tell me not to be apathetic. It's the greatest crime. All right, I understand that. I may continue to talk about filet of soul and my dog for a while and the red brick buildings and how I can feel the semen in the brick. I mean, S-E-A-M-E-N, the semen in the brick. It was an area where the semen were waylaid over the years. They go into their bars, get you know, knockout drops, next thing they'd be put on a ship somewhere. And I could feel this in this area, the Barbary Coast. You walk down these streets, it's filled with, like, art galleries, antique stores, a lot of lawyers for some reason. Thankfully, most of them went out of business in the last year, and the buildings are vacant. But they were formerly like little hotels for seamen and, you know, dance halls, that kind of thing here in San Francisco from the Gold Rush era. The buildings date to, like, you know, Civil War, post-Civil War period. I've always liked, even when I went to St. Louis, I'd go to the Gas Lamp District. If I went to Seattle 20 years ago, I'd always go to Old Town. I always liked Old Town. Old Town, Old Town. Whatever city I'm in, I go to the Old Town. Why is that? Like, when I went to Quebec when I was a youngster, I used to love Quebec because of the feeling of the old city, of old Quebec, the paving stones, the Chateau Frontenac. I used to love shooting down that, what do they call that, where you go in like a sled, a toboggan run they had at the hotel? Wow. You get a bottle of brandy, you drink half of it, and you get in the toboggan. Before you know it, it's you're sailing along and you're having fun. What do you want me to do? Politics, food, music, science, poetry, global warming, how to care for children, vitamins, the care and feeding of children, as I say. Anything you want me to talk about would be great. I think that the time for liberals and conservatives in this country to come together and defeat the Islamo-fascist before it's too late is really upon us. Unless the radical liberal comes to understand that his greatest enemy is not the conservative, but the Islamo-fascist who would stone him to death, cut his throat, this country is doomed because a house divided cannot stand. Now, I'm not the one to pull everyone together. It's impossible for me to do it. I wish I could. I wish I had the power. I wish I had the power to reach through those distorted lenses where the eye that alters, alters all. There's no way to fix people who are so blinded with hatred. You can't fix them. I've met people who are blind with hatred, and they scare me. I've met people like that in my lifetime, particularly when I was younger. I'd get into situations that I couldn't get out of, and it was really frightening to get in those places. And to then extricate yourself from them is not easy. And I've been around people who have no reason. And I don't like people who have no reason. To me, that's a form of human life that's a place I don't want to go to, okay? So I'm reading the paper this morning, the electronic paper. Italy's new dining experience, high security. Rome. Diners are flocking to what can be called the most exclusive restaurant in Italy, one located inside a top security prison where the chefs and waiters are mafiosi, robbers and murderers. Serenaded by Bruno, a pianist doing life for murder, the clientele eat inside a deconsecrated chapel set behind the 60-foot-high... Why would they deconsecrate a chapel? Anyway, set behind the 60-foot-high walls of the daunting 500-year-old Fortezza Medicea at Volterra near Pisa. Under the watchful eye of armed prison guards, a 20-strong team of chefs, kitchen hands, and waiters nightly serve 120 diners who all have undergone strict security checks. Tables are booked weeks in advance. Prison director Maria Grazia Giampiccolo said the inmates have developed a flair for their cooking. He said, I feel haute cuisine in a place like this prepares the inmates for when they are eventually released. The guests enjoy their meals, And although the security seems at first very daunting and imposing, they get over it quite quickly and forget about the guards. The mafia may be in charge, but there is no horse's head on this menu. Instead, a smart, mainly middle-aged crowd tucks into a vegetarian signature menu cooked up by head chef Egidio, serving Life for Murder and competitively priced at $33. The restaurant opened 2 months ago and has proved so popular that Italy's prison department is thinking of trying it in other prisons. I got to laugh for a minute because this can only happen in Italy, where food is life. Now, if you went to a prison in America and you had the criminals in this country cooking, can you imagine what you want to be eating? Jell-O. You'd eat Jell-O and candy bars. That would be their idea of haute cuisine. It's not Italy. Securing a table is as tricky as getting past the sternest maitre d'. Diners are thoroughly vetted by the blah, blah, blah. But there's no danger of the meal being disrupted by the annoying chirrup of cell phones. You hear this? They have to be handed in. Oh, I'd love to eat in this joint. Along with handbags, and I would like to eat here. If only I could go to a restaurant where some idiot moron from hell didn't talk on a phone. Blah, 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 I'm so important. And yeah, I'm going to Zurich. Yeah, I just got back from Atlanta. Yeah, I spoke to... Yeah, blah, 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 blah. I feel like pouring coffee into their cell phone. Why do they let them even talk? It's one of the reasons I go to restaurants. I can't listen to people. I'm in a talk business. So when I'm through working, I don't want to listen to chatter. But most people have jobs where they can't talk. So what they do is they have a glass of wine already for $6. Blah, 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 blah. I shoot their mouth. I give them 2 glasses of wine. They don't shut up. Then you get hit with a bad perfume on top of it all that wafts over and you got a double migraine and there's no point in eating there. Give me this prison. It sounds like a good place to go. Handbag. The diners go through the same thing. In the kitchen, Egidio, a burly 50-year-old from Toronto, and suddenly reigns over his team of six chefs. He screams, "The pasta is boiling over. More salt, less garlic. Keep stirring the pasta sauce," he shouts. 17 years into his sentence, he is thinking of going into the restaurant business when they finally let him out. Like any Italian, I take my food very, very seriously. I like to be sure the diners are satisfied. And they don't just enjoy the food, but enjoy it with the same passion that I prepare it. He's in for a murder sentence? He's a prisoner in Italy? Maybe we could elect him to office here. He could form an entire sentence? Perhaps unsurprisingly, given his record, diners have been reluctant to criticize. He said, "Before this, I couldn't even fry an egg. But now here I am preparing 5-course dinners, and I have not had any complaints." It could be because they know who he is. "Yeah, it's delicious, Adigio. Oh, I love it. Oh, yeah, it's great. Terrific." Yeah, tell him that his food's no good. Most of the dishes the restaurant serves are southern Italian staples from organized crime hotspots like Puglia, Sicily, and Naples. Sommelier Santolo Matroni from Naples landed behind bars after getting into, quote, a spot of bother when he was younger, which earned him a 24-year sentence for murder. He, too, is hoping to use his new skills when he gets out in about 7 years. He says, "I'd like to think that when I get out of here, I can start a family, maybe get a job in a restaurant or hotel." Hey, you should come to America. You know, it's the kind of immigrant we need. The unique nature of the restaurant has imposed some restrictions. Guards watch over the inmates in the kitchens at all times, and the cutlery used as plastic as other plates, said Mr. Giampiccolo. Yeah. "The main thing is trust, and we trust the inmates to behave. If we didn't, we would not allow this to happen." Yeah, well, I'll tell you the subtext in a minute. Diners profess themselves delighted. "When I heard about it, I thought it sounded fun, so we booked a table. And I have to say the food has been very good," said off-duty police officer, blah, blah, blah. "The fact that the dishes are prepared by murderers, armed robbers, mafiosi, or terrorists doesn't really bother me, though I might be worried if someone had been convicted of poisoning." And that's it. Italy's new dining experience, high security. For years, I would go past Alcatraz Island, and I would think to myself, my God, what a great restaurant this would make here, instead of a waste. Why don't they just let some restaurant guy open up Alcatraz, and you take a boat to it and eat there? I once told a story that I was in Fiji very late at night after a Yangona party. We were drinking Cava Cava all night. And I was in the village, I don't know, 3-4 miles away from my home village where I was staying on the collecting trip. And for some reason, I did not want to stay in that village. I just didn't want to stay there. I don't know what it was. And it was like the middle of the night, and I was compelled to walk back to the other village. Now, my guide didn't want to go with me. And he said, "Michael, are you sure you want to go at night?" I said, "Yes, I've got to get out of here. I haven't any idea why." And I left on my own, and I said, "I'll find my way back." Well, I walked back along the edge of on a trail. It was on the edge of a bluff. I knew the ocean was below, and it was crashing below me. I could hear that, and I could vaguely see it. It was a dark night. It was not even a moonlit night. But I followed the footpath, and I got back safely. The next morning, my guide showed up, and he said to me, "Do you have any idea what you walked on?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, come back with me." We went back on the path. In some places, the path had less than 2 inches of soil to the right of the path, and I would have fallen a couple of 100 feet to my death, and of course the liberals would have been much better off, I'm sure, without me. But I didn't. Now, how do you explain that? I didn't see the path. I kind of felt my way in the dark. That's not a religious or supernatural experience on one hand. On the other hand, could you say that an angel was guiding my feet? How about the time I was hit by a car when I was a young boy, and I bounced halfway back across the street? I walked out from between parked cars in Jamaica, Queens. I got just bang. I don't know. Why did I get killed? Why did he just graze me? Why did the driver stop and say, are you okay? Or did I get killed then, and did I die, and is this all a dream?
I'm Michael Savage. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
Attention, the rumors are true. The Savage Nation is moving. Listen to me, Michael Savage, starting January 2nd at noon. Noon, right here on Hot Talk 560 KSFO. So here's the topic for tonight. I was trolling through the news, and everyone's bored to death. And there is news, don't get me wrong. But you're not interested in it. You've heard it all. You're not interested. Most people are winding down for the day. They'll get the news somewhere else. They're tuning in to this show for another reason. Other reasons, rather. And I feel the same way. When we were moving towards the holidays, we come out of a holiday, moving into another one. People want to bury their head already. It's enough. This guy is crazy. They feel Obama's crazy. Let's put it to you this way. Most decent Americans think the guy is out of control. It's one radical leftist bam in the face to the middle class after another. So then I see a study, the Harvard Youth Poll on Obama, and they don't like him anymore. And I said, that's surprising, number one. They don't like him at Harvard. But I've long ago dismissed Harvard. Not so much because I'm an anti-elitist or I'm jealous. I will remind you that I've gotten a great PhD from a great university. And so it's not as though I'm an uneducated man who's kind of anti-education. My PhD is from the University of California at Berkeley, and a damn good one at that. But that's not why we sneer at Harvard. We sneer at Harvard because they become rather irrelevant. We can predict almost everything that they publish in the sense of political, especially the John F. Kennedy School of Government. We say, oh, liberal bastion. And so we dismiss it. And again, one other caveat. My father-in-law, who passed away a number of years ago, was a Harvard law graduate, fought in the World War II in the Navy, a very distinguished man. He was I never talk about family members, ever. But he deserves to be heard about at some point. It's not worth talking about right now. Just say there's a little Harvard in the blood, okay, on the wife's side. My people were immigrants, never went to college. The other side, Harvard. Her mom was a valedictorian at Radcliffe, even though she came from very poor white people. She worked her way up to that. So it's not as though I don't understand the elite university system. I do. It's just that Harvard long ago got discoupled from reality. So I thought. And yet I see this study, and they don't like Obama, and they would, you know, it's mainly over Obamacare, but there was so much more to it. So let me summarize it. First of all, it was a rather objective poll. I'm talking about the Harvard University Public Opinion Project, published December 4, 2013. And they interviewed about 2,089 18 to 29-year-olds between October 30th and November 11th. And they tell you that they did this, and they asked about that. And look at the demographic profile of those they interviewed, which was quite surprising, because you know what Harvard has become. Well, so we thought. 49% of those interviewed were male, 51% female. All right, whatever. 59% were white, 20% Hispanic, 13% African American, 7% other, and 2% two or more races. Okay, fine. 19% are Catholic, 14% are fundamentalist evangelical, 13% are Protestant, 3% Mormon, 1% Jewish, less than 1% Muslim, 10% another religion, 23% cited no religious preference, and 13% declined to answer. Now, this is the surprising part of this poll coming out of the Harvard Youth Poll. 45% with a religious preference say that religion is a very important part of their life. That's interesting. 20% are married. 12% are living with a partner. 2% are divorced. 1% are separated. And 64% of the Harvard youth polled have never been married. All right, so, okay, we're moving along here because it moves up to Obama. 85% use a cell phone, 19% use a landline, and 3% use VoIP. 79% have an account on Zuckerface. 37% have the same on Google Face. 35% on Twitter Face. 30% on Instagram Face. 25% on Pint Interest. I think it's Pint Interest. Never heard of it. Yeah, Pinterest, never heard of it. 16% on Snapchat. 10% on Tumblr. And 5% on Foursquare. Now, my day, Foursquare was a reference to a... I can't say it's a family show, so we'll move on. 6% of the sample indicated they're in high school. How could this be in high school? Oh, you mean these are not Harvard students? This is just a general study of youth. That's why it's somewhat objective. I thought it was kids at Harvard. That's why it's starting to make sense to me. And that's why some of them were actually married man to woman and woman to man. I'm sorry. So they did a poll of normal people, sane youth. And here's what they came up with. Ojama job approval at low... I'm thinking of pajamas. I try to order a pair of flannel pajamas. Ojama job approval at low point. Approval of both parties in Congress also declines. Well, that we know. So people hate Congress, and they hate the president. Less than a quarter believe the nation was headed in the right direction. In our survey, which focuses exclusively on young Americans between the ages of 18 and 29, those millennials, I don't like these phrases, but millennials are only slightly more likely to be president of our family than the general population as a whole. Now, here's the shocker. A majority support recall of Congress and the president. Could you believe this? 17% of those who voted for Obama in 2012 would not support her if they could recast their vote today. 4% would vote for Mitt Romney if they could. I don't know. Additionally, we found that a majority, 50%, would choose to recall all members of Congress if it were impossible. That's an amazing statement. 52% would choose to recall all members of Congress if it were possible.
This is an encore presentation of the Savage Nation.
I drive into the city, go to this Chinese restaurant. Now, for one, the parking is enough to give you indigestion if you get there, and it's terrible, just awful. That already gives you indigestion. There's no point in going. So I get there. I've eaten there for 20 years, and they still mistreat us. It's just that I don't know if it's the nature of the business. They don't like me. It's racism. I don't know what it is. I can't tell. I get in there. I order a number of dishes, and I'm meeting a friend. And they bring us immediately the pot stickers and the steamed dim sum within 5 minutes. I said, well, tonight's going to be different. Now I'm 3 beers into the meal, and there are no dishes, and everyone who came in after me is eating. 8 times I get up, where's the food? Then they bring it out, and the rice is at the end, and it was a mess, okay, a nightmare. I'm never going there again, but wait, the best is yet to come. My friend John, who's a philosophy professor, shows up a few minutes late, and he comes and he says, I had to park in a driveway around the corner. I hope I don't get a ticket. So right away, that's double anxiety. I don't blame him. There's no parking. Then he runs out 5 minutes later, and he puts a note in his windshield which says, please don't tell me. Call my cell phone number if you want me to move. Sure enough, in the middle of the meal, ring, ring. Oh, I'll be right out. I'll be right out. So I go out with him because John is a philosophy professor, and he's not street smart. I just had an instinct I better be with him. Sure enough, there's a crazed Russian in the street. He had parked not only in the guy's driveway, but right against the guy's bumper, and the Russian is insanely mad, screaming and yelling, you have no brains! No brains! No brains! No brains! Stupid, stupid, stupid brain! No brains! What, you have no brains? Why are you parking like that? And he's crazy. He's livid. Now, I know how to defuse street situations, and John, the philosophy professor, doesn't know anything about this kind of interchange. Everyone has their strengths and weaknesses. I'm trying to calm things down. I had had 4 beers already. So I said to him, look, tell you what, just calm down. You have no brains! No. And he's screaming and yelling the Russian, no brains, stupid! And he's in everyone's face. So I said, this could escalate, turn very bad. You know, guns, knives, you don't know what's going to... Crazy relatives from the Ukraine could come out with tattoos from jail. You don't know where this is going to go. I'm trying to defuse it. So I'm saying to my friend, look, back the car up. I said, if there's any damage, I will pay you. I figured money talks, right? I wasn't saying it was anyone's fault. No brains. I don't care. Damage. No brains. No brains. And he's on and on with the no brains. I said, look, my friend is a philosophy professor. I don't care. No brains. Why on my car? So I said, John, back the car up. John backs the car up, and there's no damage whatsoever. So the Russian gets down on his knees. He says, no brains. Stupid. No brains anyway. I don't care. Damage. No damage. Stupid. No brains. So I said, look, is there damage? If there's damage, I'll pay. No brains! Stupid! Stupid man! I said, look, is there damage? And I'm saying, John, get in the car and get out of here. I'm going to take care of it. Go! And John doesn't go. John sits there and starts in with the guy, I want to see you smile. I said, oh my God. Now, the worst nightmare, you're telling an enraged Russian to smile? What does he think, this is a textbook in Marin County? He wants to see a smile out of an enraged Russian? He parked on his bumper. You know what that's like? That's like pulling out your private part and pressing it against his wife's jeans in the street. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? All right, look. I understand people expose themselves when drunk in Russia, but you don't touch wife's pants with private part. You'll get killed for this. It's the equivalent of, what are you parking against the guy's bumper for? It's bad enough to be in the driveway, but if you're going to park there, you don't put it on the guy's bumper. It was like a new car and little, and it looks like the guy worked all his life for his first new car. And to him, this was like a sexual encounter. It's like, all right, in my country, I know they get drunk and they pull it out, but they don't touch wife's pants. It was like on that level of insanity, the guy parked against his car. So I said, get out of here. And he's out of the car telling the guy, I want to see you smile. I figure a relative is going to come out and say, what you say to my uncle? Smile? In Russian, the worst insult, tell a man to smile when he's angry. I mean, to me, it looked like I was going to blow up into World War III. So I said to him, get in the car and get out of here. Not here. So again, telling the guy that he didn't mean it and he wants him to smile. So I said to him, and the guy's screaming, I don't understand America. American people, stupid. Stupid American people. So I said to him, I looked him in the eye and I said, but you like America, don't you? See, I knew how to turn the situation because I know in Russia, a little bit about the Russian mind, which is that you can hate the person, but if you're a guest in another person's country, you don't hate the country, because in his country, you get killed for hating someone else's country or your own country. I mean, he knows from his own reversal that through history, if you say you hated Poland and there's a Polish man in the street drunk, he'll kill you. You see, I hate you, but I like Poland. It's a strange kind of Slavic sense of humor that you have to understand how to defuse these things. He's stupid, friend, no brain. I hate Americans, stupid, don't understand them. But I love America. So it was like that kind of thing. Finally, it ended. So naturally, I'm never going to go back to that restaurant. That's all. You have to have been there.
I uncovered the vitamin lie today that came out. It's a completely fraudulent study put out by the vitamin antivitamin industry. A completely fraudulent study. So here's what I want you to understand. If you're a liberal, I want you to believe CNN and not take any vitamins. If you are a liberal, I want you to believe CNN and throw away all your vitamins on the assumption it's a waste of money. Please, do Michael Savage a favor if you're a liberal. Throw all your vitamins down the toilet. If you love America, I suggest you continue to take megavitamins. And for those of you who don't know anything about the subject, I will enlighten you tonight, because I went past the headlines. I'm the only one in the media who can do it, in the sense that the others are not in this field, and I have been in it for many years, 40 years. And when I cast my eye over the actual study in the Annals of Internal Medicine, the researchers themselves said that the study itself is not reliable. Why? Because of the noncompliance of the subjects in the study. Did you hear what I'm saying? In other words, they did the study themselves, the doctors, not the schmucks at CBS, not the science illiterates at CNN, who said multivitamin researchers say case is closed after studies find no health benefits. That unto itself is a mark of ignorance. The first rule of science is no case is ever closed. So when you see a bunch of shills like this, shills for the drug industry, who tell you vitamins are no good, soda is no good, salt is no good, but marijuana is great, and all sorts of prescription drugs are wonderful. They're drug peddlers. So CBS, CNN jump on this study and say, cases closed after studies find no health benefits. Well, the statement itself is unscientific. All scientists know that no case is closed. It's the same BS that you heard about global warming. Cases closed. Man is causing global warming. How many times did you hear that from the fraudsters? So, as I say, if you're a liberal, don't believe a word I'm saying. Throw your vitamins down the toilet. I want you to believe CBS and CNN. I want you to stop wasting your money. I want you to throw your vitamins in the toilet if you're a liberal. On the other hand, if you're a reasonable, rational human being, you will listen to what I'm about to tell you. The scientists and medical doctors who did the study themselves, check out the Annals of Internal Medicine where the study actually appeared, not this written by the idiots at CBS. They said the noncompliance amongst the subjects was so great that the study had no validity, basically. Now, number two, this is the same thing that the Mayo Clinic did years ago. The Mayonnaise Clinic, again, is a tool of the AMA and of the drug establishment. The Mayonnaise Clinic, years ago, tried to disprove the great genius of our time in medicine, Linus Pauling, and they did so in, of course, a fraudulent way. The Mayo Clinic said that they did a controlled study of vitamin C, et cetera, and they found it have no use whatsoever. What they didn't tell you was the dosage was too low, number one, and the source and quality of vitamin C was never described. That is like saying driving a certain car is the same as driving every other car. Vitamins differ in quality just as does booze, whether it be scotch. You could buy $5 scotch or $500 scotch. So why shouldn't the same thing be true in vitamins? Not all vitamins are the same. So the quality, is it active or inactive? Was the vitamin C active or not active? We don't know. So the same with this study. We have no idea if the vitamins were valid. Maybe they were sitting in the back of a truck in Mexico in the heat, in 110-degree heat for a year before they used them in the study. Would you know that? No. Therefore, the study is flawed. So I'm giving you a little version of it. There's a lot of politics coming later on the show and a lot of other things. But I'm giving you just the vitamin thing first. So I'll ask you a vitamin question, which is this. Would you continue to take vitamins after this fraudulent study published by CBS saying cases closed? Who do you believe? Who do you believe? CBS, CNN, or Michael Savage? Who do you believe? Dr. Michael Savage, who spent 40 years in this field and has a PhD sufficient to understand the study. I didn't say that I'm the greatest genius on earth, but I can read the study. I guarantee the schmucks at CBS and CNN who wrote this article at the behest of the drug peddlers can't even read the study and understand it. So that's number one. And then I want to say this. People ask me many times, why do I do radio? How did I get into it? And I said, jokingly sometimes, that one of my role models is the great French writer Voltaire, going back several hundred years. And Voltaire was asked why he writes. And he said, I write to express the foibles of the Parisians. They're so absurd. And he was hated for it. That is why I'm hated in California, why I'm hated in San Francisco. And I'll get to that in a few moments, because there was a garish party of the worst kind for Gordon Gekko's 80th birthday. Gordon Gekko had an 80th birthday party in the Pacific Heights. And if you take a look at the pictures linked up from the SF Gate on of all the, quote, society types, I mean, it's filled with the miscreants, the prostitutes, the inheritance cases, the non-productive citizens of the world. And what kills me the most about the Gordon Gekko party, when you look at who attended, you understand why Voltaire continued to write about the foibles of the Parisians the way I write about the foibles of San Francisco. There was Nancy Pelosi. You got to see these pictures. You have to go and see them. You have to see the pictures. A picture is worth 10,000 words. And you will not believe what I'm trying to tell you. It's unbelievable to me. The socialist infection, masking itself as a form of liberalism that has spread across the United States, began here on Pacific Heights, probably in Gordon Gekko's toilet. There was a birthday party for Gordon Gekko, and it confirmed my suspicions. It was glorified in the social pages of the local news rags. And it was a true celebration of the so-called social elite, the upper liberal crust. Composer and philanthropist Gordon Gekko, or shall I call him Gordon Petty, opened his Gold Coast home right next to Nancy Pelosi to 600 people to celebrate his 80th birthday. Now, what's interesting here is that Mr. Gekko was forced to skip the gaudy show of wealth that he put on 5 years ago because of the down economy. But apparently now the economy is doing so well that the pure liberal evil and the faces of evil, not even a touch of evil, if you look at it, it oozes out of the pictures. $25,000 dresses talking about the one, $25,000 dresses talking about the immigrants. I didn't see any illegal aliens invited to Cisse Puede's party last night. They talk about global warming while flying in their Gulfstreams all over the world. They profess vegan diets and the wonders of veganism. Meanwhile, Gecko served lamb chops. Nothing has changed in the 150 years since this outpost of civilization called San Francisco came on the map after the gold rush. San Francisco is still filled with these vulgar individuals living on the wealth of their grandfathers, offering nothing to the society other than their own opinions of how you should live. In 49, the miners came. In 51, the whores. And when they got together, they produced the native son.
I'm Michael Savage. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
So you...
I got to tell you, this is a side note. It's an interesting little side story. It's not as good as Charlie the as Barney the Undertaker. God, I remember those Cadillacs. There was an Undertaker. The same guy showed me my first corpse down there too. It was interesting. That, you know, I didn't put that in the book. I must have been the same age. Hot day, July, Coca-Cola, icebox outside, grocery store. They call them bodegas. Then they became clubs. You fished in the bottom of the Coca-Cola box. They had ice in it that turned to water, and your arm turned blue as you fished around for a soda, that kind of day. And the Undertaker's there. My father was busy working in the back of his little shop, making a lamp or cleaning. I don't know what he was doing. He wired a lot of statues into lamps, and he was busy doing that. Hot day, I'm outside, so I ask him what's going on in the mortuary down there. You know, it was a funeral parlor, but they performed embalming. They did embalming. She said, well, would you like to see what goes on? I said, okay, sure. So get in the elevator, and you get it. It was one of those elevators like in lofts where you pull a big cord from the top like a Godfather elevator they move cars on. And to this day, I can hear the hum of that elevator, the motor. And I'm going down this huge car elevator into the basement, the subterranean depths of a funeral parlor. We get down there, walk into the... And there's a doctor performing an autopsy. No, it wasn't an autopsy. Sorry, this was the embalming story. And, okay, that's it. So there it is. Now I come back up on the street. Must have been a half an hour later. My father's in the undershirt outside the store, and he's looking for me. Hey, Michael, where? And he turns and he sees me. And when his eyes caught my eyes, he saw I was a changed person. And that's my Undertaker story.
Field, that ball is going, it is gone. Maris hitting his second homer of the day. And the Yankees, sixth homer.
And there is the nostalgia setup, the Mel Allen voice, one of the greatest voices radio has ever heard, and one of the earliest radio voices that I came to love. And here I am, sitting in front of a microphone with a radio voice that millions love, now with another story that will be in my autobiography. And it's called My First Embalming, since we talked about The Undertaker, and here it is. I was now a late teenager, and I had gone to Europe, big trip to Europe. You know, hippie, beatnik trip to Europe, see the museums, blah, 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 came back on a ship. I come back from Europe, and I thought I had become a little off base. It was a little kind of teenage angst, little nuts. So I took a job in a mortuary at Queens General Hospital. I can remember it to this day. Red brick, big smokestack, looked like a crematorium. And I go in there as an assistant to just basically mop up and sweep up in a mortuary. And I had never seen an embalming. I don't know why I took that job of all jobs. It was like a bizarre choice to begin with. I guess it proves I was a little off-base after going to Europe. But then again, I wouldn't be the first nor the last person to come back from Europe and think they were a little crazy. Just take a look at Europe. So I go down into the thing, and the guy gives me an apron and a mop. And he says, "Just basically, your job is to mop up the floor." But meanwhile, I'm watching the autopsies. This was not this is really my first autopsy, not my first embalming. It's my first autopsy. So I watched a doctor. Now, here's a doctor with a medical degree. He was a medical examiner performing an autopsy. He has a cigar in his mouth, which I thought was weird and kind of disrespectful to the dead. The guy is chomping on a cigar. He cuts open a dead woman's head, like the top of her head, to pull back the skull cap and to remove the brains for, you know, that's what an autopsy is you examine the organs. And I'll never forget it as long as I lived. She happened to have been an African-American lady and a large woman, and he was pulling and pulling and pulling, and the skull wouldn't pull off, and he puts his foot up against the gurney that she's on, or the stainless steel thing, and pulling and cursing and the cigar, and I'm mopping the kid in the room there. I couldn't believe what I'm watching. And finally, he curses, and there it comes out, and that's it. So now then I see another man. A man must have been 50, 55, white man in good shape, just slim, gray-haired, but not old-looking, dead. And he was completely naked, as you would expect, on a slab. And the kid's mopping, and I look very carefully at the corpse. And I noticed some semen on his thigh, which again was novel and unique, because I didn't understand much about death at that time, as much as I since learned. And then there was a young child, 2 or 3 years old, as beautiful as a doll, blonde hair, blue eyes, like a doll, still and dead, for no reason, still and dead for no reason. I quit the next day and threw in my mop.
Warning, the Savage Nation contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, the Savage Nation, home of borders, language, culture. And here he is, Michael Savage. This is an encore presentation of the Savage Nation.
I feel good, and something's wrong. I don't get it. The news is horrendous. The world is aflame because of Obama's insanity. Democracy, they call it. Libya is on fire. It's reduced to tribalism. Egypt almost fell into the Nile and the Mediterranean because of Obama's insanity. Syria is on fire because of these insane people. Now they're trying to push the Ukraine to look to the West, join the EU, not Russia. And that idiot McCain sure gets around. My God, what is he on? Who's his doctor? I mean, what do they have this guy on? Does he not understand what he did with all of the other mistakes he made? What can I tell you? I have a question about Ukrainian women. They're known to be amongst the most exotically beautiful women on the planet. Everyone knows that. This, you know, like stunning. But if you look back, like post-war, Stalin era, why did they all look like babushkas? 195 to 235 pounds. What is a dietary change? Are they all on chlorophyll now? How did this happen? Anything, the thing about beautiful women like that is pretty clear anyway. At 18, they can stun you. Your legs go out from under you. By the time they're 40, they still look like Stalin's housewife with a babushka, no matter what you do. No matter what they take, it's still the same thing. You know, at 18, anyone can be beautiful at 18. Get back to me when they're 45. Babushka City. Stalin's housewife. Horrible.
Here's how it works. And it's a hard story to tell. It's a hard story to start. But once I get into the story, it's going to be very easy to tell. I don't have a way to begin the story other than to tell you I was on my bicycle before the show. In one of my moods. I go in and out of moods. And grousing about. I just read that there was a Russian in New York who bought a $150 million apartment. So I started to get mad. Grousing about that, saying, I don't understand this world I'm living in. There are guys coming back from Iraq without legs and arms. And this guy has enough money to buy another $150 million apartment. Well, something's wrong with the picture here. So I said, look, I have a choice right now. I could sit here getting angry, or I'd get on my bicycle and take a 10-minute ride, because I remember that many years ago, 20 years ago, I read a couple of self-help books. And one of them said that in the few minutes that you're sitting there grousing about how bad things are, you can send a letter, make a phone call, run around the block. And you know what? It helped me then, and it helps me now. So I got on the bike, and I went down to a kind of isolated area where they're building some new houses by the water. Because I love to watch houses under construction. It's very optimistic to see the wood and the contractors and the this and the that. And I'm out by the point, and I'm coming back, and I see this big, black, Great Dane off a leash. Now, I happen to be afraid of black dogs. I mean, big black dogs. In fact, big white dogs. In fact, big dogs generally frighten me because I was bitten when I was young, right down to the bone, and had to be hospitalized. So I have a real respect for dogs. So I said, now, I got to be very careful as I go by this Great Dane. I don't know whose it is. If I let out anger inside of me, the dog's going to feel it. If I let out fear, the dog's going to fear it. So I said, just be cool and go. Don't go too fast. Don't go somewhere. So I go by. The dog doesn't bother me. I said, thank God for that. Then I come upon a guy who's got a truck who's doing auto detailing. And he's a big black guy. I've seen him once in a while. Huge. I mean, like a football-sized guy. And he comes out of the truck and he says to me, you're looking good. And I said, what? He said, you lose some weight. And we start to talk. I didn't know the guy. I've seen him around. But he thought he knew me. He said he knew me. Not thought. He knew me. For a number of years, he's been around this county doing cars. A great guy. I'm going to tell you the story now, where it goes. So one thing leads to another. And he says to me, you remind me of another radio guy I knew. He says, this guy was as smooth as can be. He could walk the ghetto. And he could walk the White House. So I said, you know, let me tell you something. I said, David, I grew up in New York City, and I had to learn how to swim with all kinds of fish. New York City was a very big fish tank. And if you didn't learn how to swim the right way, they'd tear your fins off. And he laughed. He says, well, they wouldn't just tear your fins off. He says, they'd eat you for breakfast. And we started to talk. Now, he grew up in a black ghetto here in Marin County. There is one, and it was called Marin City. It's an interesting story unto itself. The housing was built by the magnate, Kaiser. When they were building Liberty ships in World War II, they needed to bring in workers, and they didn't bring them in from Mexico. They brought workers in from the South, and they were largely black people, and they built housing for them. And you may not know, for many of the ship workers, you know about Rosie the Riveter, of course, but you didn't know that most of the Liberty ships were built by black people, particularly out here in Sausalito at the Kaiser shipyards. So the housing was built nearby, and it's become basically, largely a black community. And naturally, the way things have evolved in our society, and blame whoever you want, it hasn't been a picnic for the people living in there. We were walking around, and well, we were just standing there talking about the dog and the this and the that. So I said, well, how did you come through that place and come out the way you are? You see, he's a pastor. In addition to running a service that, you know, polishes cars, he happens to be a minister. His name is Pastor David Hall. And I'm going to tell you more about that in a few minutes and where this went, how that went there, and how positive this man was. And we were laughing. He says, you know, I know people around here, very rich people. He says, their children can't play with anybody. I said, why? He says, well, I told him the reason your kid can't play with anyone is because you've given them everything. They got all these toys. They sit in the house and they play electronic toys. They don't know how to play with anybody. I said, isn't that a shame? And I told him that I'm a people person, that I basically am not really a loner. I don't really like to be alone. But I figured if I got out on the bike, I said, I'd run into somebody to talk to. And I said, sure enough, this was like hitting, you know, the triple lottery for me in terms of the kind of person I am. It's like all four cherries came up on that big, slot machine in the sky of humanity. And this goes back to when I told you a story years ago about me and Brother Billy down in Harlem when I was a kid. But that's a whole separate story. But this is going to lead somewhere else. So we're talking and this and that. We look up a hill where they're building the houses above where he's polishing the cars. And he said, when I was a kid, he said, you know what we used to do for fun? I said, what? He said, we'd slide down the hill on, like, linoleum. I said, I can't believe it. I said, we did the same thing. I said, I lived in a tenement on a block called Longfellow Avenue in the Bronx. And above me was a hill called Bryan Avenue. Between us was a big, empty woodlot that had a huge hill on it that was denuded of foliage. And we'd slide down it on oil cloth, you know, old linoleum. And I said, well, we'd also play war. He said, how'd that work? I said, well, we'd take the garbage can covers. We'd put them in our hands, and there'd be like a gang of us. I'm talking kids 5, 6, 7 years old. No one had guns or knives. And the game was to run up the hill against the other street as they were raining ash down upon us. And like Gladiator, bounce, bounce, bing, bing. And I said, my head would get split open 100 times in these things. I always had a knack. I don't know where the ash guys, you know what the ash is from? He says, no. I said, well, in those days, I said, they had garbage that they would burn in incinerators. And the leftover of that burn was like a volcanic ash. You know, thank God they don't do it anymore. And I said, these kids would get the ash out of the incinerator and rain it down upon us. And you'd have to fend it off. You can go home, you'd get killed. So I said, many a time I'd come home with my head bleeding, with blood running down my head. I'd come home, my mother would faint before I got through the door. She was like a panic case. She'd go, oh, my God. And she'd fall on the floor basically screaming and yelling, I'm bleeding, and she's doing nothing. But I said, next door, I had an aunt who was like stoic, like Russian aunt. Nothing fazed this woman. She'd look at me with the sober face, get out the peroxide and bandage it up, and that was it. So he lit up, David did, and he says, when are you going to write that book? I was like, bung. I said, what? He said, when are you going to write that book? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, all those stories of your youth, he says, those are great stories. Well, we talked about so many different things. And it turns out that Pastor David Hall of the Big God Ministries is running a turkey drive for Thanksgiving, and he's trying to, you know, do the right thing. And I'm going to send a little money over there. But the point is, he said, would you like to be with me on the 19th and the 20th as we give out turkeys to the poor? I says, yes. He says, no one will know anything about you. You'll just be another guy handing out turkeys. Yeah, I'm going to hand out turkeys. How do you like that? And send some money for turkeys. So he went back to when he was poor, and he said, he's, I got to tell you, so I grew up on welfare. He says, my father left us when I was five. He says, I'm one of six children. And he says, yeah, I ate the government cheese. He says with a big smile. He says, yeah, I grew up on the government cheese. And he says, I'd say to my mother, he says, Mom, if there's a God, why am I hungry? Now I said, oh, God, what a question. I said, kids are so smart. I said, they're brilliant. And he said, my mother told me, never be bitter, never be angry, always have faith. Now, this is the most important part of the story. Is the faith that this man had. He didn't turn to bitterness. He didn't turn to anger. He didn't hate Whitey. He didn't hate America. He just did what he did, and he did it, and he did it, and he did it. And you know what? He's the richest man I've met in recent years. He is the wealthiest man I have ever met in the last 10 years.
I'm Michael Savage. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
Do you?
So here we are. If you have any questions, I may have the answer. If you have any answers, I may have some questions. Let the envious and ignorant call, 855-400-SAVAGE. You know, if I had a choice, who would I, let's someone gave me a choice. Savage, you have a choice. You can go to dinner with Vladimir Putin or Barack Obama. I don't know the answer to that. I'd like to go to dinner with both of them, but it would have to be on my terms. It would not be in the Winter Palace, and it wouldn't be in the White House. I would take them to a restaurant of my choice in the Bay Area, a hidden location. They could have full security, helicopters overhead, armored vehicles, 500 KGB and Secret Service agents. But if I took them to one of my favorite haunts, and we could just sit down with Teddy at the table, I think I could solve the world's problems with them. I can make them happy and laugh. They'd probably let down all of their guard, and everybody would enjoy themselves. Wouldn't that be fun? If we could just sit down with me, I can bring people together. Right. Sure, Mike. Keep dreaming. But it's a Hobson's choice. Who would I rather go to dinner with? Putin or Obama? Putin is a first-rate, frightening man. KGB, judo expert. Been around an awful long time. We definitely know he was born in Russia. We definitely know he loves Russia. We definitely know he's a nationalist. We definitely know he's one of the wealthiest men on the planet. Okay. Now, on the other hand, we have Mr. Selfie. We're not sure where he was born or when he was born. Well, we pretty much know when he was born, but it's still to this day not 100% sure where he was born. We don't know where his loyalties lie. We don't know if he believes in America or supports America. That's a given. Nobody knows. Very shadowy, very hard to pin down. And he's not a judo expert. Although he is losing weight, I'm a little concerned for the man's... I don't understand that. Why is our president losing weight so rapidly? Are we allowed to ask that question? I'm asking you, why is he so thin? I'm worried about him. Thin as a rail. That's a worrisome question. The man is losing weight. So whatever. Maybe if we went to dinner and I give him some vitamin advice, you think that would work? I wonder if that would work. I don't know why I feel good. Something's wrong. I mean, I don't get it. This is the funny thing. It's like the old Buddy Hackett joke, which I loved when I was a kid. Remember Buddy Hackett? No one knows him. He was a comedian in the 50s. I was a little boy. I used to love this guy. Doughy comedian, Catskill Mountains, very, very funny guy. So he got up on the stage. I saw him, I think, on the Ed Sullivan Show. I was a little kid who knew, and he says, I don't know. He says, I don't know what's wrong. They drafted me in the Army. They sent me to Fort Dix. He said, for 2 days, I thought something was wrong with me. I checked into the infirmary. The doctor said, what's wrong with you? He said, I don't know. I don't have indigestion for the first time in my life. I laughed hysterically because I grew up on the same kind of horrible diet that killed all of the male lineage in the family going back 2 generations. The heaviest, fattiest, saltiest, creamiest food God has ever seen. And then the women, after the men died, moved to Florida and went on vegan diets. They're 95 years old, living there with walkers and transfusion trees. Go figure. Oh, that diet, are you kidding? The Queens, New York diet killed my dog, Tippy. I think he died at 8. That kind of mixed breed should have lived to 12, 14, even in those days. You know what's interesting? Dogs are living longer. Like they say, like, 70 is the 50 of, like, wait, 50 is 70? I don't know what it means. The 70 is the 50 of yesteryear. You know what I'm saying? Something like that? Or 70 is the new 50? Yeah, 70 is the new 50, or something like 50 is the new 30. So what does that mean? 20 is the new zero? Like, a 10-year-old is a homunculus? What do they mean by that? A 15-year-old is now a homunculus or an embryo. I mean, what are they talking about? So anyway, dogs are living longer. You hear, like, I get worried because Teddy's 10 or 11. I can't imagine, like, life without him. I've had other dogs. I have their ashes in a jar. Okay, I haven't forgotten them, but it's not the thing. I'll give an example. I have a certain, I'm playing all these jazz, the jazz music now in my car. So I listen to Coltrane, or I listen to the others. Not so much Coltrane anymore. He's great, but I'm not listening to him. So Teddy and I listen to a certain set on the radio. Every time I get in the car, it's on the CD now. And he gets in the seat on the right, I'm on the left, and we drive, and it's like he's there and I'm here. He's snuggled down, we look at each other, and I know he knows it's the music. So like today, he goes to the groomer, Irene. He goes Mondays and Fridays to get his hair done. He gets his permanent, very much like a New York lady. Has to have the hair done Monday and Friday or doesn't feel good. So I'm like without him today. So I get in the car. I had to go somewhere to lunch to meet Dimitri to get that picture that's up on my website. And the dog's not there. And I hear the music and my heart drops. Would you believe it? Do you ever have that feeling? I have that feeling of gloom and loss. Like I look over, the dog's not there, and I think, it's his music. Where is he? How can you be this attached to a dog? It's not healthy. I'm sorry, it just isn't healthy. I don't understand it. So anyway, he's 12, but they say, oh, don't worry, little poodle, little, small dogs live long today. He's spry, he can leap up like a lynx. If I say leap, he leaps like a lynx from the ground to like 2 feet. I don't know where he gets the springs from. Everyone gives me dietary advice about my dog. They're all wrong. Don't give him cheese. It's bad for the... I never heard such nonsense. They're all diet experts in America today. Everyone's an expert on not only on themselves, but also on animal diets. He loves cheese. The dog loves provolone cheese. I give it to him. I don't mean every day. He'll do anything for cheese. He gets his kibble. I get him a chicken breast off the bird, the whole bird. I buy the whole chicken and nothing but the chicken. I tell you the truth. I buy the entire chicken. I cut the breast. He gets the best part, no skin. And he gets chopped carrots. He eats better than you do. Okay? And then once in a while I give him some provolone as a treat. He can still jump at age 10. No idea, he would have been gone already. 10 would be like 70, right? 7 to 1 was the formula then? Years ago, they're already gone. They're looking at Megyn Kelly's lipstick.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE. 855-400-7282.
Amherst, New York, Deanna, welcome. Oh, is it Deanna or Diana?
It's Diana.
It's like that, hold me, squeeze me, Diana. Okay, it's Diana.
Yeah, it's like Lady Diana. First of all, you sent me that book, Train Tracks. I called the other day. And I wanted to tell you, The Speculator in a Garden of Numbers, that is a genius chapter. It's just genius. I keep reading the same pages
people
over.
People don't realize that I began in literature as a poet, as a story writer. And I was a scientist for many years with a real PhD. And I've been a talk show host for 18 years. I've had many incarnations. But that story that you just mentioned, The Speculator in a Garden of Numbers, is actually a minor American masterpiece. It's about a time that I tried to become a speculator in cocoa stocks, and I thought I was making a fortune when I lost every penny I had. And it's what I went through as a poor young guy who had some money and started to speculate and got ripped off by a commodities broker who steered me wrong. But I mean, it was an amazing story, and it's a really up and down.
Fully riveting. I wanted to tell you thank you. I don't know how many people ever call and just thank you for something you sent them, but I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Hold me, save me, Diana. That is a good story for now, the speculator in a garden of numbers. I don't know if I'm going to read it now. Yeah, I'm going to read a piece of it. It's from my book, Train Tracks. I'm going to read one or two paragraphs. He was not of a wealthy family. His father, a small shopkeeper, now dead, had managed to rectify his penniless immigrant childhood position, but never managed to attain what was known as a comfortable status. The son was warned about investments at an early age. On one of their many summer rides in the Catskill Mountains, they both watched a raceway being dozed and carved out of a distant cornfield. The small father lectured the smaller boy. Sure, they move a little earth around, get you to invest in their scheme, and after they've milked the public for all they can, they declare bankruptcy. They can keep their racetrack. The small boy believed his father's every word. He worshipped the forceful, handsome man for his ability to say loudly what he felt, not just within the confines of the household, but outside as well. The man knew what he was talking about and told you so. Well, the raceway was slowly but certainly constructed and eventually operated very successfully. Those who had purchased shares in the embryonic raceway corporation were rewarded for their faith with substantial capital gains. The son never mentioned the completed track to his father, though they would pass it each summer over the years. There would be no point in proving his father wrong. He was right about too many other things for this error to have any impact on their relationship. As the little boy became a man, his father grew neither more rich nor more poor. His income remained the same throughout the years, rising just slightly with inflation. The small family home was always secure. The children had enough money to attend the municipal college, and the two parents, with simple wants, were able to go away every summer to a bungalow in the mountains. The family dry goods shop was managed with honesty and without credit, and provided a moderate but secure income. The father would justify his moderate position from time to time, as one friend or another would move to a more expensive home, take a cruise, or purchase something truly showy. He would lecture the boy, his daughter, and his wife about his friend's foolishness. He simply did not believe in the American dream. He smelled a fraud, but was unable to prove his suspicions until many years later. One of his friends, a corpulent man he had grown up with on the Lower East Side, went bankrupt. The journey back from his expensive home out on the island to one room in a poor relations apartment with his three children took less than 1 year. It seems that women no longer knitted as they did during and after the Second War. The little man's children were pulled out of school to earn their food, while the once prosperous yarn merchant became a clerk in a competitor's shop. Sadly, the boy's father took pleasure in his friend's plight. I told you he was overextending himself. All the years he came in here and shot his mouth off. Look where it got him. All the time borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. I knew all along it was no good. The bankruptcy of the yarn man served to shore up the position of the dry goods man against investments and credit borrowing. The boy learned to respect his father's position even more firmly through this lesson in reality. Another of his father's successful friends came to ruin in a different way. His daughter died from an overdose of heroin in an infamous New York hotel frequented by unsuccessful artists. Once again, the man's moderate approach to life seemed to be the right one. Though his children would not distinguish themselves in any great way, they would not bring shame to the family either. As time would have it, the dry goods man died in middle age of a second heart attack. The boy named Sam, now a shaky man of 31, had on his own managed to accrue what would have been a small fortune to his father. The capital was not exactly earned illegally, but it could not be said that the money had been earned from legal endeavors either. It seems that taxes were not paid on income derived from a bookstore that drew substantial profits by selling books purchased from illegitimate sources. The young man managed to save between $80,000 and $90,000 in a little more than 3 years. The cash sat in a safe cemented in the basement floor of Sam's mother's house. The young merchant let it sit there without making any investments. He distrusted Wall Street as a result of his father's indoctrination over the years, and never learned much about any other financial opportunities available to the small investor either. However, Sam always heard that real estate was good, a nice, safe way to build a fortune. But each time Sam would make an offer to purchase a small parcel of land, the deal would not be consummated. He would make an unrealistically low offer, which would be rejected. On receiving back his deposit, He would feel as though he had somehow made money simply because he had not lost any. It's pretty good. You know, I'm reading this to myself right now on the radio show. This is the Savage Nation from my novel, from my short story collection, Train Tracks. And you know what it reads like? This is, it reads to me almost like a Chinese short story. If this was written by an author from China about a family in China, the Chinese would love this story. It should be translated into the Chinese. Anyway, let me go on, and I'm going to stop in a minute, because I'll show you where it's going, and then I'll stop, and you'll read the book yourself. The 5 or 6 parcels he failed to buy increased 2 or 3 times in value over the 3 years he kept track of their prices. This confirmed Sam's appraisal of his business sense. He thought he was a shrewd buyer, but lacked the faith necessary to put his money into an investment. After 3 years of testing himself, he was ripe for making a dramatic move. He would no longer wait around to die like his father, while enormous profits could be realized by signing his name to a few slips of paper. Sam was an avid reader. He not only sold books, but inherited that love for the written word that was woven throughout the fabric of his people. He had just read a small book about useful plants of the world and was convinced that coffee and cocoa were highly underpriced products of the soil. Cocoa, he thought, is an agricultural product with good associations. Coffee and cocoa were both grown only in the tropics. Through an acquaintance in the shop, Sam learned of the commodity exchanges, where products of every kind were bought and sold by both those who utilized the products and those who merely speculated or invested on the rise or fall of prices. By making a few phone calls, he learned the name of a commodity man at the largest brokerage house in the city. After a few cordial conversations with the broker, during which he learned the rudiments of speculating in cocoa, Sam the speculator was anxious to cash in on his hunch. The broker told him that a minimum amount of $5,000 would be required. Anxious as the young man was, he did not rush over with the money. For several days, he just phoned the broker to get the opening and closing prices and ask a few new questions. Finally, the broker pushed him a little. He suggested that the market appeared ready to rise and told Sam to get his deposit in an account. That evening, the speculator decided to go to the safe and withdraw $5,000 cash. In the morning, he failed to open the bookstore for the first time in 3 years. Instead, the cash was converted into traveler's checks in 6 separate banks. Sam thought this would throw the tax people off should they be following his cash flow. He also did not want to alarm the broker. The exchange at each bank went well, with the exception of the 4th transaction, where the teller asked Sam why the money had such a peculiar smell. He acted dumb, muttering something about a trip to Spain, while remembering that the years in the safe had probably caused his dough to mildew. Leaving the bank, he was sure the dumb clerk would report the incident to her superior. He only hoped the supervisor had become used to mildewed bills in this time of inflation, when many people were removing their stashes from little corners of the world. You know, it's interesting. I wrote this 30 years ago, and it's kind of more current today than it was in the 1960s or 70s, I think, when I wrote this. It's good writing. I like it. If I like it, you like it. If I like it, it's good writing. So anyway, I'm going to read one more page from The Speculator, from Train Tracks. Then we'll go back to normal programming, which is always abnormal. And I'll go on now from Train Tracks. After the final transaction of traveler's checks into the cashier's check, a brief subway ride took him to the center of world finance. Following a few directionless meanderings, he found the brokerage house. It occupied an entire city block, was of brown glass and steel, and rose higher than any other building in the district. The young man felt better about his decision when he surveyed the magnitude of the structure. New thoughts came pouring from his brain. So that's how such buildings come to be, he was thinking. Men buy and sell and buy all over the world, and this company takes a commission whether the investors make or lose. Either way, the brokerage houses profit, he thought. He was amused by the cleverness of the scheme, but still felt positive about his decision to, quote, get into it, as he weaved his way through a maze of people in the lobby who were glued to changing stock prices flashing above their heads. At once, he no longer sneered at these people. He understood them. He was part of them for the first time. Ah, those phony artist friends of his would not need to know about his new attitude towards them. It would be sufficient that at last he was part of reality. Once on the 27th floor, he found his way to the commodity broker. They both acted intimate with one another, as though through the telephone conversations they had discovered they were brothers, and were now at last meeting for the first time since their separation at an orphanage. For a while, they both just sat and watched the gigantic board where prices for wheat, corn, soybeans, live cattle, hog bellies, coffee, cocoa, silver, platinum, and other items clicked and changed with mechanical excitement. Sam noticed that the broker was not alone before the big board. He was one of a dozen or so brokers in the large and well-designed room. As the young man casually glanced at the other faces, the cigarette-stained fingers of this very thin broker tapped nervously on his desk. The thin man whispered, "You see that man in the back at the last desk? He earned over $1 million last year just in trading cocoa." The young man was impressed but not astonished. He knew people made that kind of money, and here was one of them in the flesh. That the million-dollar earner did not look different from anybody else made him all the more believable. As the young man imagined what the rich man's home and wife looked like, the kind of dinners prepared for them by their cook, and the manner in which they entertained themselves, he asked the broker almost in a whisper, "He makes that much just from speculating in cocoa?" The thin, nervous broker educated him. No. We are not allowed to speculate for our own accounts. He makes that on commissions alone. He is the man who handles the Hershey account. He buys and sells all their cocoa for them. So that's how they get their chocolate. Sam felt much more involved with the real world than ever before. He realized that soon he would be participating in the buying and selling of chocolate, just as this international corporation did from right there in that office, simply by having his broker watch the changing figures. He gave the check to his broker and watched him walk with it to an accounting office at the far end of the room and placed it in a pneumatic tube. Jim, the broker, returned and said, "It's done. Down the tubes by now. Your account number is 0137. The young man was made a bit nervous by the broker's choice of words, but he immediately realized the expression, "down the tubes," probably originated in such investment houses to describe the passage of messages, checks, through pneumatic tubes which traversed the building. He further reassured himself by repeating the many names of the partners of the famous company. I'll pause right now. It's about 30 pages more. The Speculator in the Garden of Numbers from my masterpiece, Train Tracks. You're listening to The Savage Nation. I'll be right back.
Join The Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE. 855-400-7282. Savage.
I'm amazed that I get paid for doing what I do for a living. I mean, seeking the truth and my commitment to it is amazing how much I love this. As I say, some days are better than others. This is a good day. My inflexible perseverance in stating what I think is right is what keeps me going. And when I see a study like this, I've got to come in and step into the breach. Also, it's also near the end of the dark year. The nighttime show will come to an end. I'll be off, but I come back for New Year's Eve. Mark it down. I am doing my last night show. I'm having a party on air New Year's Eve right on this time, in this time, on this station. We're going to have an on-air party. I don't know who I'm inviting yet. I don't think it'll be Gordon Gekko. But nevertheless, we're having an on-air party. and then January 2nd is the live Drive Time show. And to celebrate that, I had new pictures taken. Unbelievable. Go to michaelsavage.com. You want to see quality? There I am. Teddy's right next to me. My dog is my co-pilot in this case. I mean, I don't believe, I believe in God, but saying dog is my co-pilot. There he is in the right seat. And we're both looking straight ahead with my hand on the wooden steering wheel of the old Jag. It's an incredible picture with boats in the background. My friend Dmitry Stroganov, the artist who painted Teddy, took the picture. It's astonishing. There's the new image for the new show. We're driving to Drive Time. I debunked the flawed study which tried to debunk the use of multivitamins based not upon my opinion but upon the science itself, because the study, if you read the study, concludes from the authors who say the noncompliance indicated they couldn't conclude anything. What does noncompliance mean? The people who were supposedly taking the vitamins wouldn't take them. Nonsense. Utter nonsense. But okay, believe who you want. I want to repeat what I said. If you are a liberal and you hate me because of your ignorance and your lack of education, I suggest that you go to your vitamin cabinet and flush all your vitamins down the toilet. Please, make my day. Stop taking vitamins. If, on the other hand, you are a reasonable person and are open to realities and evidence, then keep taking your vitamins. It's that simple. Oh, vitamins no good. Waste of money. I used to hear that in the late 60s and 70s from the Professor Hacks, when I was emerging in the vitamin world as a leading writer and researcher. Oh, yes, America has the most expensive urine in the world. I heard that from all of the wise guys. The most expensive urine in the world. They try to, put down vitamins. Meanwhile, it grew into a multi-billion-dollar industry for good reasons. It has great health benefits, so people wouldn't take them. People are not stupid. They feel better taking vitamins, especially if they know what to take and how much to take. And this idiot, they put out a study, cases closed. As I said to you early, and I have to keep repeating it, the first rule you learn in science is there are no absolutes. So you can't say the case is closed without proving you don't know the first rule of science. They used the same lie about global warming. You remember that about 5 years ago? Case closed. All scientists agree the Earth is warming. Then they stopped that because not all scientists agreed. The case was not closed. All science is emerging all the time. You ask any real scientist, not a public relations hack. So no, the science is not in. It's one study, and it's a flawed study. Why do I say flawed study? Because I went to the original source, the Annals of Internal Medicine, and if you read the last line of the abstract, it says, because of the non-compliance, the study is not that valid. What does non-compliance mean? Many of the subjects who were given the vitamins wouldn't take them. It's that simple. Tom, tell us your story.
Yes, I take five different supplements, and I was able to get off two inhalers and Singulair, which is a...
Oh, you better not tell your medical doctor about that. You better not tell your Obamacare specialist. He'll recommend you be imprisoned for getting off medication.
Well, I've been off it for 6 years.
Oh, my God.
And can I tell you what I take for it?
Well, you can. I wouldn't recommend it for anyone else with asthma, but go ahead.
Okay. I take 3,000 milligrams of vitamin C in divided doses. I take 4,000 IUs of omega-3. I take 500 milligrams twice a day of magnesium. And I take vitamin D, 4,000 IUs.
And it works for you. It suppresses your asthmatic reactions, correct?
Yes, I have no problem.
That's all. End the story. Now, that's one testament. Thank God for ADD. Untreated ADD is the greatest gift to people in radio. But believe me, it's worked for me. Anguish, misery, and creativity. That's my new motto, by the way. I thought about it. My whole life has been AMC. Anguish, misery, and creativity. If you learn how to actually ride anguish and ride misery, it will lead to creativity. Do you know that? If, on the other hand, you drug anguish, you will not even get to misery, and you lost a tremendous emotion there. Because in order to go up, you got to go down. So you got to go from anguish to misery and then to creativity. It's the Savage Rule, AMC. I'm serious, by the way. I'm not making this up. It's what came to me today. I'm sharing it with you. So look, if you've had a good time tonight, go to my website. Look at the new picture of Teddy and I in the old 70 Jag. Number one, Savage Movie, The Drive. Mark the date, January 1, and I will be with you, God willing, New Year's Eve, December 31st, for my last show in this time slot, right on this station. And the next day we move to the new time slot, and the rest will be history. It's up to the future. I can't predict the future. All I can do is live in the present. I do believe that the gurus are right who said, you know, be here now. I do be here now. On radio, I'm more be here now than anything I've ever done in my life.
Warning, the Savage Nation contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, the Savage Nation, home of borders, language, culture. And here he is, Michael Savage. This is an encore presentation of the Savage Nation.
Now, here's what I'm going to do. I prepared all day to talk about the difference between a statesman and a politician, meaning, let us say, Mandela versus Obama, because there is a difference. And I was going to compare the two, the difference between a statesman and a politician. And we may do that later. I have so much wonderful preparation on that. And then I thought, I don't know if people care anymore. The economy seems to be selectively booming. I know that that's a controversial statement, and the conservative diehards are saying things have never been worse, the sky is falling. And yet I look around, it seems like we're living in boom times again. I know, I say unemployment's down, jobs are up, but then you say there's 10 million, 11 million people on the fraud, the disability fraud, then they're fudging the numbers. Yet the stores are jammed in San Francisco, you can't get in. People are beating each other with umbrellas. You can't get in restaurants. So it's the best of times and the worst of times. It depends upon where you live and how you're living. Rents. Where's the money coming from for the rentals in San Francisco? No one can afford it. Where does the money come from? If we're in such a depression, which the Republicans want to consider, we're in the worst recession in history. No, we're not. No, we're not. It's not the worst in history. Yes, it's printed money. Yes, no one knows where it's going to end. But I didn't want to talk about that. Here's what I want to talk about. Since Obama eliminated the filibuster just 2 weeks ago, I will filibuster on this show tonight for a congressional investigation into the Navy SEAL deaths on that old Chinook helicopter back in 2009. Remember, I dedicated a novel to that called A Time for War, and nothing happened. People bought the book. I've had the parents of the dead SEALs on the show. And I'm sick to my heart that so many SEALs could die in one crash, and there's not been, A, an outcry by the American people, and B, no congressional investigation as to who in the White House or the Defense Department put all of those 38 SEALs on that old helicopter and sent them to their fiery death. So I begin my filibuster tonight. I've read you the opening before about them on the helicopter and it crashes. And now we go to chapter one because it's set in the Bay Area, and many of you listen to me in the Bay Area. Tell me what you think about this. It's my novel, A Time for War, Sausalito, California, headline, killing all 38 Navy SEALs on board. Jack Samuel Hatfield slapped off the alarm on his clock radio. The words hadn't quite registered as he blinked to clear his vision, try to make out the luminous red numbers. He pushed the black hair from his high, strong forehead, dragged a hand across tired eyes. "You're late, champ," he smiled as Eddie bounded toward him from the foot of the queen-size bed. The four-year-old gray poodle, all tongue and forepaws and big brown eyes, usually woke him up a minute or two before the 6 a.m. alarm. Jack dug his fingers behind the dog's ears, and Eddie drew back his head and jerked approvingly. Jack ended their morning ritual by pulling a well-worn chew toy from the drawer of his night table and flinging the toy to the floor. Eddie followed, landing on the rubber stake with a single mighty leap and a whimpering squeak from the stake. "Lie back and think of England," Jack told the chew toy. Then he groaned. He hadn't been awake 2 minutes, and already England was back on his mind. Eddie had landed on the rubber stake like the full weight of Britain's blinkered bureaucracy had landed on Jack, who was still banned by the British Home Office from entering the United Kingdom, along with terrorists and criminals. Normally, it never crossed his mind, but he had a lead for a story he was writing on the smuggling of illegal Chinese medicines. The lead was in London, and London was off limits. Jack stood up, his body automatically adjusting to the gentle sway of the 40-ton Sea Rider. The cast-off bedsheet buried Eddie, who pulled his toy to safety and continued gnawing. Jack Hatfield, Jack thought, the defrocked talk show host and the last truly independent journalist in America, hounded by the illiberal left and defamed worldwide, needs coffee. But he still headed to his office video editing station in the converted lower deck stateroom before he made it to the kitchen. He clicked on the radio and started going through his email. Prince William and the lovely Princess Kate will be touring. He turned off the radio. They probably spent 60 seconds on the Navy SEALs, he muttered, but they'll spend the full 5 minutes on the vacation plans of royalty. Every day, he wondered, was his profession dead now? How about now? News channels were afraid to report anything that their audiences might whine about, never mind topics that could scare them. Changing people's minds was serious, vital business, and nobody had the guts to do it anymore. Jack had received regular death threats when he was hosting his cable news talk show, Truth Tellers, but they had never discouraged him. Instead, it had taken all the resources of a giant to swat Jack down back when he posed one simple rhetorical question to the panel on his former TV show. Quote, "How would you feel if Muslim extremists got hold of a nuclear weapon?" Within hours, MediaWire, the leftist radical watchdog group founded and funded by reclusive Austrian-born billionaire Lawrence Soren, had organized a smear campaign. They had been looking for a hook on which to hang Jack like a slaughtered bull. He was labeled an Islamophobe, and the liberals gleefully piled on with the kind of manic indignation only aging hippies and ignorant youth could muster. By the time Soren was done, Truth Tellers had not only lost half of its sponsors, but Jack was out of his job, and he was barred from the United Kingdom due to his, quote, radical and provocative statements, close quote, that were deemed a threat to public security. Eddie trotted into the office, the chew toy in his mouth. He laid down and sank his teeth into it. Now Jack was freelance, but San Francisco had been quiet for weeks. The most promising story was the smuggling. His phone rang. The caller ID said it was Max. I don't care if it's good or bad, he said into the phone, as long as it's news. It's one of yours, she said it, so it's news. Maxine Cole, 27 years old, was a triathlete of Somali descent who'd moved to the United States when she was a kid. She'd spent her teens in the projects, but got herself out by teaching herself how to shoot network-quality video. She'd managed to keep her street sense and her fearlessness, too. And the result was a co-worker who could keep up with Jack in any situation, no matter how dangerous. The arrest of the state senator's son, he asked her. Yes, she said, I read your report. Jack had sent it to her for a few tweaks and some feedback. Listen, Jack, she continued, for 99.99% of the world, this report is going to be exactly what we expect from you. But I have to say this, I think you're dialing it in. You're not fully into it. Jack was silent for a minute. Then he said, you're right. Just a tiny bit, like I said, no one except me is going to notice, but I didn't feel right not saying something to you. It's just that it's not the smuggling story, she asked. Exactly. It's a rich kid getting arrested for drugs. Meanwhile, in China, there are farms where bears are caged, lying on their backs with no room to move, with tubes in their abdomens to collect bile for so-called medicines. Some of the bears have actually committed suicide by starving themselves to death. And multiple smuggling operations are carrying the bear bile, along with body parts from tigers and other endangered animals, out of China to the rest of the world. I covered it on Truth Tellers until the networks got too scared of offending their Chinese investors. Now I have a chance to break the story again, and I can't. She said, you have contacts in London. You can ask them to follow up on it, can't you? Yeah, but it's not the same. He didn't reply. She knew him well. It wasn't that he didn't trust his contacts to do a good job. He simply wanted to be the one doing it. They said goodbye and hung up. San Francisco, California. Standing just over 5 feet tall and slight as a snow pea, as her father put it, there was nonetheless something about 26-year-old Maggie Yu that commanded the aisles of the Yu Market on Clay Street. It was partly her posture, erect and centered, creating a straight line from the top of her head to her feet. It was partly the serenity of her expression, her dark eyes never seeming to blink. Her lips together in a relaxed line, her round face untroubled with lines or color other than the natural blush of her cheeks. And it was partly the unwavering focus she brought to the task at hand. I'm reading from A Time for War by Michael Savage. It's a filibuster on my part until Congress holds an investigation of who put all those SEALs on that single helicopter. There's never been an investigation. Maggie finished checking the inventory her father had brought in before dawn. Fish, vegetables, beverages, candy. Taking a last look around, the young woman placed the clipboard on its hook beneath the counter. She removed the apron. The century-old brass bell tinkled above the door. Maggie smiled as she welcomed the first customer, Mrs. Chan. The smile was sincere. She was surrounded by love. One of the love objects was her father, Johnny Yu, who had opened the grocery store in 1986, the year before Maggie was born. It was originally going to be named the Hung Pu Market for the river where he used to sit as a boy growing up in Shanghai, his eyes on the ships that used to come and go, one of which a freighter eventually took him to his new home with his new bride. But Anita Yu did not want to be reminded of their old life. She insisted he name the grocery for his ancestors, but also for himself and Yu descendants. He agreed that that was a better idea. I then described the store itself, which I will skip. And then the third thing Maggie loved was the Chinese population of San Francisco. Today, the community had over 100,000 citizens nestled between the financial district and Nob Hill. The citizens were vibrant and resilient, hardworking men and women devoted to their families, their neighborhood, and their nation. They were patriots with affection for their ancestral land, but with a fierce love for their current home. But, sadly, there were also some, the fewest in number and certainly the least in moral character, who exhibited the kind of selfish ambition that tore the community apart a century before in a series of wars fought to control criminal activity. These people troubled Maggie. She saw them every day when they came into the store, usually young men, usually buying cigarettes, chips, or soda. They always looked out the door while they stood at the counter. There was something itchy about them, restless, eyes roving, shoulders rolling. They just seemed ready to take, not from her or her father. Shoplifting was too small. Besides, the locals knew she was ready for them, and there were security cameras behind the counter. These misfits preferred to steal cars or electronics outside the community so as not to embarrass family. They sold drugs or laundered currency to those who were not Chinese, until today. The bell jangled again. A Chinese man entered the store as Mrs. Chan was leaving. He was in his early 30s, and she had not seen him emerge from the black SUV double parked outside, but there was no doubt it was his. The smoky windows were like his smoky sunglasses, secretive, out of place. He removed the glasses as he approached. He wore soft tan gloves. It wasn't cold enough for that, not even on a chilly winter morning. The man was sharp, from the even lines of his buzz cut to the strong set of his square jaw to the rigid creases in his tan suit. He was short, only about 5'6". But the way he stood when he reached the counter, with his shoulders drawn back and his feet close together, made him seem taller. "I would see the owner of the shop, please," he said, glancing about the store. "My father is not here. How may I help you, mister?" "Lee," the man regarded her, his eyes very still. "You can help by telling your father I wish to speak with him." Maggie did not believe his name was Lee. That was the equivalent of Smith or Jones in America. His schooled, non-colloquial English reinforced the woman's impression that he was not from around here. She guessed he was a Chinese national. His severe bearing, his neutral identity with personal nuance drilled away, suggested a military background. And he obviously wasn't here to sell her father anything. He wasn't carrying a tablet, a briefcase, or even a cell phone. Protection, she wondered? That was the enterprise of local thugs who knew better than to come here. Besides, the shop was on a block of mom-and-pop stores and restaurants. Shakedown money from all of them wouldn't pay for a week's worth of gas in this Escalade. "Dad will be here in about 3 hours," Maggie told him. "If you want to come back, my business cannot wait. I'm afraid it will have to." The man had barely moved since approaching the counter. Now he took a step forward. Several candy bars fell as he pressed against the child-high shelves in front of him. When he spoke, his voice was soft but firm. "Call him, please." Maggie continued to smile. This man, these men, whatever they wanted, had been thrust on them, something urgent. "There are two things I can do for you," Maggie said, raising her voice. "I can give my father a message, or I can sell you something. Which would you like, Mr. Lee?" Lee smiled faintly. It was barely noticeable. But Maggie saw it. She knew he was about to grab her. She knew it from her 22 years as a fighter. The fourth thing Maggie loved was a kung fu. She had been training since she was 4 years old. First with their neighbor who held a black belt in a Nabi Su form, then at a martial arts school that practiced Jeet Kune Do, the hybrid style developed by Bruce Lee. She had earned a black belt before she turned 14. The essence of both styles is that energy comes from the ground, from the air, from the world around the martial artist, who gathers it in his center and drives it forward. The attack often comes in a variety of animal styles, whose offense and defense were studied and adapted by the ancient Chinese. In the split second that the man smiled, Maggie planned her attack. She knew she had the size advantage. In kung fu, smaller is faster. She knew she had the counter to work with, to use as a barrier, or maybe she could double him over on it. And she knew that she had quiet skills while he had pride and arrogance, the worst hobbles a person could have in a fight. Just then her father appeared from the back of the store. "Everything okay, Maggie?" he asked. "Not really, father," she said. "The man wanted to speak to you." "Do I want to speak with him?" "I don't think so," Maggie said. Johnny fixed steady, unrelenting eyes on the man. "I don't believe you are welcome here." The would-be attacker, denuded of all pride, took one look at Johnny and the two mourners. Maggie could see him calculating the odds in his head. He turned and hurried out of the store, the doorbell jingling on the way out. The street sounds were momentarily louder and the door slammed. There was a moment of silence. It's called A Time for War. I'm Michael Savage. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
My dad, God rest his soul, owned a small antique store on the Lower East Side of New York. And he specialized in 19th century French bronzes. And they were gorgeous. You know, I learned a lot about art because I stared at them all day long. Now, you may say, oh, what do you know about art? I know a lot about art, believe me. Trust me, I probably know more than the art historian of your choice. So these figures would come in with a brown or black patina, which is the accumulation over the ages. And it was gorgeous, the patina. But the nouveaus who were buying the figures to turn them into lamps wanted them to look like gold, because underneath the patina was the original bronze color. So, okay, all right, Ben, I'll take that, I'll turn it into a lamp, you know, mount the thing, blah, blah, blah. So they'd buy it, and a certain number would be left for the weekend, and I'd have to clean them in the basement, down into the pit, dirty, horrible, dank, huge old wine barrels, a toilet from hell, no mirror on the wall except speckled from the acid that hit the mirror. I'm down there for, I don't know what age, 14, 12, 15, I don't remember, with a toothbrush. There was only one other guy he would hire to do it, this guy named Louis from the Bowery. Nobody else in history would do this. Get rubber gloves up to my elbows. And you would drop these
white pellets into water, turn it into a cyanide solution. And then you would take the brush and you'd rub the figure until the patina came off the bronze. And I'm rubbing it. It would take an hour to do each one or two. Rub. And you're a kid. You're rubbing, and what you're thinking about is where you're going to go that night. You're going out on a date. You're going to hang out with your friends. You're going to drag race, whatever. Meanwhile, my face would be blotched. And I'm rubbing and cleaning, and it's like a Dickens basement. So one day, so I go into high school chemistry, and I said to my teacher, I told him what I was doing. I was using cyanide balls. My father had a huge chemical supply. No, it was not used for anything but this. And I said to the teacher, I use these cyanide balls for a cleaning solution. They said, what? So I went, it's poisonous, he said to me. They use cyanide balls at San Quentin to kill people. But he said, don't get worried. There's a sodium cyanide, and there's a potassium cyanide salt. Attention, the rumors are true. The Savage Nation is moving. Listen to me, Michael Savage, starting January 2nd at noon. Noon, right here on Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
This is an encore presentation of the Savage Nation.
Now, you know me. For 6 to 9 months, I've been here in the Siberia of talk radio, about to enter prime time, and I've seen a trend emerging in talk radio that's been alarming to me. And I've tried to say to you that I'm trying to send the message out to my conservative cohorts. They don't listen to me. They don't like me. They hate me. In fact, they probably have more enmity towards me than Axelrod does. I would say with almost a high degree of certainty that if Axelrod ever listened to my show, he probably, in the old sense, understands my jazz much better than do the conservative cohorts that don't have a tin ear for music. Let's put it to you that way. Now, having said that, I've tried to tell them, if a person tunes in your show and counts to 15 and they hear the word Obamacare, and they could do that any time of the day or night, or they hear a diatribe against Obama, they're going to turn your show off. Not because Obamacare is a success, not because Obama's not an emerging dictator. No, that's not the reason. It's because it's boring radio, and everyone forgets that radio is an entertainment medium. I have to keep repeating that. You don't understand what I'm saying to you. We cannot become so partisan that you only hear the same tin drum pounding over and over and over and over. For 9 hours a day, I don't care when you tune in or who you tune in, you can count to 15 and you're going to hear the words Obamacare or Obama. And you say, okay, I heard that. So let's put it another way. When I was a little boy, there were movies, there were serials in the movies. Like each week there'd be another serial, let's say the Lone Ranger. And each week the Lone Ranger would come back on the screen. It would be the same Lone Ranger with the mask and the horse and the sidekick. But it would be a different story. You understand that? Now, if I went to the movies and in 3 weeks in a row they ran the same Lone Ranger serial, I would start throwing popcorn at the screen. And then my friends and I probably would have burnt the screen off the stage. We would have done something violent. We don't want to hear the same serial every day. We heard it. We know the story. We know Obamacare is a bomb. We know what Obama is emerging into because he always had these inclinations. Now let's move on. The problem is it's hard to move on when you can't move on. It's hard to move on when your stock and trade is Obamacare and Obama. So that brings me back to me. I'm gambling, and I have gambled, that I will have to say it like it is, my versatility in talk radio was going to bring me to where I wanted to be in radio and save not only myself but the format. Have I proven that to be true yet? No. I'm only at the end of the beginning, not at the beginning of the end. I've done one solid year in this dark time on talk radio, walking on hot coals, crawling on glass, and I got some ratings that came out. I can't give you the exact amounts, but I'm going to give you one example. I gambled now, and you have to hear this. If you're a talk radio fanatic, you're going to want to hear this. On KSFO, where I appear in San Francisco, which I consider my hometown, it's not that I love to hate it. I love this city, and I live here, and I've lived here since 1974. On this station of KSFO, this station in my time slot is number two in the market. Number one is an all-news station. In talk, I'm number one. I beat the old KGO. I beat KNEW. I beat the KKSF. I beat them to a pulp. So you say, okay, well, that proves you're right. You're right. Your versatility is attracting the audience you want. Now, the real test is going to come when you, my audience, are given the opportunity to tune in my show, Drive Time, January 2nd, when I'm live. First, it switches on January 1st, but on January 1st, we have something different planned for you. On January 2nd is my actual first live show. So you have a chance to actually vote with your listenership on January 2nd. And we'll find out after 3 to 6 months whether my move towards a versatile show and away from this partisanship will pay off in radio. If not, well, I've done what I had to do anyway, because I can't do the other thing. I refuse to do it. I refuse to do it. So that's one topic that I don't want to talk about, even though I've just spent about 8 minutes talking about it, which is Rush Limbaugh being moved off KFI in Los Angeles, which is the biggest station, to perhaps the smallest station in Los Angeles. I mean, remember, KFI is a monster station. Nearly a million different people tune into a day part, an afternoon drive, and sample that station for at least 5 minutes an hour. And that's where Rush was heard until now. And he's being moved to another station where only about 100,000 people listen in on average. In New York, WABC is a monster station. It's heard up and down the Eastern Seaboard. But you won't hear Rush Limbaugh on that station anymore. No, he's headed across town to the letter deficient talk station in New York City. And so things are happening in this country right now, and you have to be aware of them. And there are different forces driving these changes. You know, in 1975, Michael wrote The Taster's Guide to Beer. I was so into it, I did home brewing. It was an amazing story, The Taster's Guide to Beer. I put my heart and soul in it, as I did most every book I wrote. I wrote Plant a Tree, about how to regreen America. I should have won the Presidential Medal of Freedom 30 years ago for what I did. I was like Johnny Appleseed, Paul Revere, all combined in one. But I wrote The Taster's Guide to Beer, and here's a funny side story. The other night, out of the blue, on Monday night, way after the show, it was late, cold, horrible, I got in the mood to go back to a dump that I used to go to in San Francisco, a real dive. I can't even mention it because it's such a... They serve like buffalo. I wanted a corned beef sandwich. I guess I was in a state of mind of wanting to abuse myself. So I wanted to eat like a familial food on a cold night. I wanted to eat the food of my ancestors that buried all the males in my line going back four generations. So I went over there. I risked my life in the streets. The bums, the crack dealers, it was frightening. I went in there, I stood in line, I got a corned beef sandwich, but I used to drink beer in there because they had beers of the world. And do you know what came back to me? If you find an old copy of my book, The Taster's Guide to Beer, 1975, Macmillan Publishing, with a color insert. Maybe someone ripped it off by now and stole my copyright. I wouldn't be surprised. If you find someone robbed me, let me know. I'll sick my lawyer on them. I'll reissue it. When in that place, I had the corned beef. By the way, it was dry. It was tasteless. I found out why, by the way. All the beers of the world, they cut out a lot of the beers of the world, but it was so dirty. They haven't changed the carpet. They haven't changed where you push the glass for water. They haven't changed that. They haven't changed anything in 40. I don't understand this. Maybe the funk is what brings the young hipsters in. I know they're jammed with the Euros and the hipsters who think it's cool to eat in a dirty place. I don't know. The corned beef is no good anywhere, I heard, anymore. I don't even eat the stuff maybe twice a year. I was told with the fat-free frenzy in America today, they don't even know how to make corned beef anywhere in the world anymore. It's devoid of fat. There's no moisture in it. They took all the salt out of it, so what's the point of eating it? I mean, if you want to eat meat, go and have boiled beef or something. Did I tell you the boiled beef story from today? I'll give it to you 1 minute. And it's not to insult my assistant. I was starving around 1 o'clock. I sent him out for lunch at a local place that I really love. It's an Italian place that knows how to cook old-world stuff. So I said, get me the meat dish. I'm sick of the fish. Most of it's polluted. I can't eat it anymore. Every time I eat fish, they all say, wild this, wild that. It's so wild, my skin itches and my ears twitch. No matter what fish I eat now, the ears are twitching. And I only lived on seafood for 20 years because of the cholesterol, this and that. So I'm going back to meat and potatoes, the diet of the ancestors. But it's lean beef, it's boiled meat, whatever. And I ordered a side of ravioli and a side of French fries and a side, to be good, on the right side of my head, there's the devil saying, go ahead, eat the meat, get the potatoes, what are you worried about? You know, you're not born yesterday, enjoy yourself. On the left side is the old health food angel says, no, you can't eat that. I said, leave me alone, I said to the angel, I want to eat it. I'm hungry and it's cold. I have to do a show today. The angel said, well, at least have spinach. get a side of spinach. I said, I hate spinach. Yeah, wait, the angel said, then get charred, get some green. So I ordered charred and the meat and the ravioli. All right, about 40 minutes later, my assistant comes back. I'm already foaming at the mouth. My eyes are bulging. I'm getting a migraine. I opened the bag. All that was in it was the chard and the French fries. I said, where the heck is my meat? What are you doing? He left the restaurant without the meat. I had to wait another 40 minutes for the meat to arrive, which I had to put in the refrigerator at that point, which is waiting for dinner when the show is over. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282.
I don't look at my ratings at all anymore, because it's almost an irrelevant to me. I have to do the show I'm going to do, irrespective of my ratings, and hope for the best. And I just looked at them today, and I'm number one in the actual talk market in my time slot in San Francisco. That's a fact. It's not invented. I'm number one. The only station that beats me is an all-news station. And years ago, when I was in this market and dominant, I beat that all-news station in many books to show you what will happen eventually with this show if I stay in the market long enough or almost any other market. Because all-news has its limitations as well, incidentally. So let's take some calls. Let's go to KTBL in New Mexico. Kurt, you're the first up. What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Let me just say that I think you're going to single-handedly save talk radio, really, sir. I don't think that's hyperbole, because I listen to a lot of talk radio, and I'm from Missouri, and I grew up on Rush Limbaugh, and you magnanimously credited him. I mean, he was the fullback that broke open the whole thing for everyone, but his show's unidimensional because he's unidimensional, and, you know, his life story is just not yours. It just isn't, and so he talked...
Well, look, I opened this topic up not to talk about Rush, but to talk about the format, because that's what it's really about.
Well, people want advice. You do that. You give your medical expertise. You talk about the culture. You talk about the world. It's not this hard. The other people are just kind of boring. They're unidimensional. You are jazz. You're FM. They're AM. You know.
Frequency modulation. What a great. Great time it is for me to be in talk radio. I've done other things. I've had other careers. But when I entered talk radio in 1994, I have to tell you this, it wasn't long before I said to myself, I intend to be in the winner's circle. Now, it's taken me 20 years. It's only been two decades. And it's sort of the old Jackie Mason joke, which I'll never forget, which he did 20 years ago. You know, everyone heard of him. I had known him when I was a little boy, and he was a comedian in the terrible hotels, garbage hotels. I remember when he was thrown in a swimming pool after his first performance. I was a little kid. I couldn't believe that. But this great comedian, Jackie Mason, came out when he did The World According to Me, I think, way back in 20 years ago, and he said, suddenly I'm an overnight success. They don't know it took me 20 years of working in toilets to get where I am. I thought it was one of the funniest lines I ever heard, but I feel the same way in talk radio, to be honest with you. Now, I got to tell you that what happened... not a happy thing, but it happened. I have no control over what's coming tomorrow. I don't know what could happen to me with regard to my career. I don't know. You know, I have a feeling I know. I know what's happening January 1st and 2nd, but I don't know beyond that. All I know is this. Everybody in talk radio wants to be on the Cumulus stations that I am on and I'm going to be on. Everybody knows that. They're the major platforms. They are the major platforms. WABC in New York. Who doesn't want to be on that? Who doesn't want to be on WLS in Chicago? Who doesn't want to be on WBAP in Dallas? KSFO in San Francisco? Who doesn't want to be on RKO in Boston? Who doesn't want to be on MAL in Washington? Who doesn't want to be on these great stations? Atlanta, KSEV Houston, JR in Detroit. WJR in Detroit is a station that everybody in radio has always wanted to be on. KVI Seattle, Michael Savage. I can go down the list. And there are many other incredible stations. I can't read them all. But I'm saying to you is that I'm going to be, first of all, I'm on most of them, but I'm going to be on most of them. And so what I do in radio is going to be a continuation of what I've done here at this time of night. And remember, I'm running up against Fox News. I'm running up against 70 other radio stations. Do you know that when I started in radio, there was no internet? We had a thing called wires we had to read, AP wires, I think UPI. We had to look for stories. It was like a primitive teletype machine. We had to go buy newspapers and magazines to get articles to talk about. Now, that brings us back to today. You're still listening to me. You have ass outlets for news. You can go to the Drudge Report. You can go to so many incredible websites and in 2 seconds find out the headlines. And you could do it 10 times a day, and you do. So you don't need me or anyone else in radio to give you the news. You don't. So what are you listening for? You're listening for a unique perspective on events, the news events. Yeah, but is that all you want to hear? No, there's got to be something else. So there's got to be my dinner with Michael Savage. What did I have for lunch? If I tell you that whenever I go out in public, which is very rare these days, I become an almost total shut-in, people will see me in a crosswalk. I'll never forget these Filipino ladies. There were three of them in San Francisco, and I was in a crosswalk. And one of them honked at one and said, Mike, are you happy today? I want to find out how you're going to feel tonight on the radio so I can feel the same way. I thought that was amazing. So this is a personality-driven business. And if you hide your personality, well, you're defeating yourself. That is unless you're a miserable person. Now, if you're a miserable person, you better hide your personality and just talk about the Constitution and about Paul Revere. That's all I can say to you. But if, on the other hand, you're a likable person, as I can be, and I'm not necessarily always a likable person, I can be pretty ornery most of the time. But frankly, I think the best part of my nature comes out in this show, and I think you hear it. And I think it brings some levity to your life. I think it, I don't know, lifts you up, gives you hope, makes you feel better about yourself. I don't have an answer for it. All I know is thank God I'm still kicking, and thank God I'm still ticking. And I would have to say that this has to do with an awful lot of factors that have something to do with the spiritual realm. I know you don't want to hear it. You don't want me to go there. Most people are not religious. They don't believe in this. They think it's, you know, hokum. I don't. I'm not a formally religious person. I don't go to a house of worship. I've tried over my life. I've never felt comfortable in houses of worship. I've tried. I enjoy them. I think they're beautiful. I think the rituals are great. It just doesn't work for me because I'm not an organizational type of personality. I like to be alone. And with me, my relationship with the Creator is a kind of very personal thing. But what I'm getting at is several times along the way, between when I began in 94 and now in the year 2014, coming up very soon, 20 years now, it's an awful long time in a career. But it was my third career, not my first. I want you to think about that. Most men would have retired and walked away and said enough is enough and done what they do. You know, you can mock retirement up to a point. But there's a certain beauty in doing nothing also. I developed a real skill in doing nothing many, many years ago. Before radio, I had read enough of Chinese poetry in English translation. I had read enough of Henry Miller. I had read enough of Lin Yu Tang to come to understand the joy of living and in doing nothing. I learned the joy of sitting in bed and reading a book. I learned the joy of drinking wine at night. I learned the joy of eating late instead of eating meat. I learned the joy of watching a passing cloud. I learned the joy of looking at a swooping bird. I learned the joy of lying on a rug and playing with a dog and so forth and so on. So believe me, it's not like I'd walk into a void if I didn't have radio. There will come a day if I'm still around and I'm no longer working, I know how to do that. I was a writer for many years. And you know, in order to be a writer, you first have to know how to relax and relax your mind that there's nothing to write about. Unless you are open, unless your mind is open and your heart is open and your soul is open, you may as well not be a writer. Now you could write a hackneyed nonfiction book, which I've done. They're great books, but they're not the same as writing fiction. They're not the same as writing poetry. They're not the same as writing a song. They're not the same as writing a love letter. You have to have an open heart and an open mind. And I don't know how many people even understand that anymore. So what I'm saying is, this is almost an existential thing I'm about to tell you. I'm hoping for the best, but I'm prepared for the worst in 2014. Do you understand what I just said to you? I work very hard at what I do, but I make it very easy as well. I drive myself and the guys who work for me very hard from 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm up and I'm reading. Now, that's all going to change come January. It's going to be a different time frame. If I get up at 7 and my show is on at 6 o'clock at night, That's 11 hours later. But I've been working for those 11 hours for that show. Well, now I'm going to get up at 7, same time, and my show's at noon, going to be at noon on the West Coast. So it's a much more compressed time frame. I'm sure the guys that work for me can't wait. So you have a half a day to do nothing. Because right now they are working hard. They're great guys. They love radio. They've been in it a long time. And they're dedicated to it. I'm optimistic, but I don't know what might happen tomorrow. Let's put it to you that way.